Our small craft headed downriver along the hot Rio Grande at a deliberate and even leisurely pace, because the engine noise at full power would provide too much warning to the cartel men manning this stretch of the south shore outside Reynosa. We wanted to see them, and they certainly saw us. Men lounging next to fishing poles eyed us as we floated past and called in their reports. A man in a squalid migrant camp shooed away rooting hogs to light a signal fire in a trash pile. Another man followed us on shore for about a half mile, hiding as best he could in the thick brush and cane, taking photos with his phone as he went. The photos, I knew, were not just for texting up the chain of command. The sophistication of the cartels includes facial recognition databases now, and we are in them. As these things went, it was a quiet day. Sometimes the cartel controlling Reynosa and environs, its Setas or Golfo or Noreste, depending on when you go, where you go, and who is killing whom most expeditiously, will direct the migrants to erupt from their squalid bankside camps and throw rocks at American rivering craft. Sometimes they'll motor up in their own boats and let the pilot know they'll kill him and all his passengers if he comes back. They haven't followed through on this yet, but it only has to happen once. Recently, they motored up cradling their rifles, and instead of delivering death threats, they told the American boatmaster to call the U.S. Border Patrol, because they were about to cross a group of illegals who wanted to be caught and released by the permissive American federal apparatus. Even that isn't the worst of it. Upriver, I spoke with a man who showed us the bullet hole in his home's facade. It was a 7.62mm round that made it. That's Soviet block ammunition, usually for the AK-47. He felt lucky. His neighbor was actually shot in the hip sitting in his living room with a full 50 caliber round. This would ordinarily be a fatality, but it was on a ballistic trajectory and went through a solid outer and inner wall of the house first. The neighbor also felt lucky. These are Texans, citizens of the United States, in the United States, describing their experiences under fire. What happened to them was fairly straightforward. The Texas Military Department was clearing out the adjacent Rio Grande island of Fronton, and the frustrated cartel men expressed that frustration by subjecting this community to indirect fire. Just another day on the border. And that's from The Children of the River, 2024, by me in thefederalist.com today, March 20th, 2024. I'm Joshua Trevino, and this is The Hard Country.
Welcome to the Hard Country Podcast. My name is Melissa Ford. I'm a policy director at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And today I am joined by Joshua Trevino, the foundation's chief of intelligence and research. And I'm also joined by a guest, Humberto Lopez, who is the founder and executive director of Fundación Patria Unida por un México Valiente. And a dear friend of both Josh and I's.
Absolutely.
So today is a very exciting day because it's not only the first time we've been recording in a couple of weeks, but it's also the first time that we are on with a guest. So Humberto, I want to give you the opportunity to briefly introduce yourself and what you do and a little bit about Patria Unida.
Thank you so much. And first of all, thank you for having me here. Thank you for the invitation and for having us, Alice and myself, here in Austin in the Policy Summit. A little bit of about Patria Unida is the first conservative think tank in Mexico doing work to defend our values and to help train and form new leaders that can stand up and can raise their hands and defend these values. So that's a little bit in brief words what we are trying to do.
Thank you, Humberto. We're so happy to have you here with us today. And there is a lot to cover today. But I figured that although we will get to why we wanted to have you on the show and give our followers a very special announcement towards the end, I wanted to start by giving you an opportunity to unpack a little bit about what you just read, Josh, which is related to, I don't think we shared that we were going to do this with our listeners, but our very recent trip to the border. We drove to McAllen, we went to Roma, we went to Fronton Island, San Ignacio, Laredo. It was a very comprehensive border trip.
We did that whole stretch of what used to be Nuevo Santander, now is Tamaulipas in South Texas.
Yeah.
And you're right, exactly. I mean, we just followed 83 up the river in a single day, starting in McAllen at 7 a.m. in the morning, and then Los Ebenos, Roma, San Ignacio, Fronton, and then going up to Laredo by the end. Your first time.
My first time.
Your first time. I mean, well, so let me turn the tables a little bit before I tell what I think. What did you think? I mean, what changed in your perception having seen that?
Well, I thought I knew everything there was to know about the border. I know that's ignorant without having been to that part about the border, but I've studied it a lot, and so
In fairness to you, you have been to the border.
I have been
just
to the border.
Just not that part.
Just not this part, which is very different than any other border, and it was completely eye-opening. I think the term to use is like a big perspective shift.
Yeah.
Because we hear a lot about what goes on this side of the border, right? All the time. We hear about how the law is no longer protecting American citizens, right? And you hear a lot about the high-speed car chases and the insecurity and the problems that ranchers face. I know that you had told me often about this story of this rancher in Stark County that had, you know, defended his country, and now he was asking, well, why is my country not defending me? I live on a ranch, and my ranch keeps getting broken into. I've encountered armed men on my land. And those stories, although they are powerful, until you hear it and until you're there and you see it, which I heard it from the same person and I got to do that, it's a whole different thing. And one thing that to me was very powerful from this trip is the realization of how much suffering there is on the migrant side too.
Yeah.
So we hear a lot about American communities not being protected by their federal government, but it was just eye-opening to be in places like Fronton Island, where we saw all of these clothes, even from little kids, that were left there after they crossed the river, or hearing stories about how people were killed when they crossed without permission. We even found, you included this in the text that you wrote, in the piece that you wrote, which is very powerful, by the way, but we found these little notes that must have belonged to little kids, which were instructing them, this is the name of your dad, this is the name of your mom. And we were able to read it and realize what it was. And so it was just a very, very powerful experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what's interesting is that one thing we saw, and I have a question for you, Umberto, is that the border is effectively, it's unmanned for vast stretches, right? Like, we saw that when we were there. There's no U.S. authority around. There's no Texas authority around, although there is more Texas authority visible than federal authority, which is very revelatory.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, much more. But on the Mexican side, it's controlled the whole way through, right? There was not a single stretch of bank that we saw.
100%.
100% cartel presence. You know, we're on the river. There's people following us. And that was true pretty much wherever we went. And McAllen de Laredo, for those of you who don't know, who haven't been to South Texas, is a long stretch. It's, I forget what it is, 250 miles, something like that. So it's a significant portion of riverbank. But I want to toss this question to you. So the Mexican side that we see in Tamaulipas is exceedingly dangerous. I mean, it just is. It's famously insecure. I think it's Carretera Federal 2 is the highway that it's essentially impossible to drive with any safety and security. Ciudad Mier, which is my great-grandmother's hometown, actually was emptied out by the Zetas about 12 years ago. 13 years ago. So it's impossible to do. And yet today, this may be news to you because you and I have not talked about this, but today I see that Claudia Sheinbaum, who is probably going to be the next president of Mexico, is actually driving from Reynosa to Nuevo Laredo on the most dangerous roads in Mexico, right? But she's driving there and they're social mediating it, and it seems fine that she's going. How is it that she's able to safely drive these roads?
Well, as you say, that road and that part of of Mexico is almost forbidden for normal Mexicans.
Yeah.
I will say it will be one of two options. Either she is incredibly, she didn't know, that I don't think that's the answer.
It's not that.
Or she's part of something bigger. She's part of something there that allows her to drive that road and to be there with no trouble. And we can remember a little bit about the actual president, AMLO. He was with the mom of one of the biggest narcos.
El Chapo. Yeah.
And that's something that a normal person will never do. Either he doesn't know, that I don't think that's the answer, or he's part of something big. And something bad. So I believe she's part of all this.
So his chosen successor's ability to take a day trip through cartel territory, I mean, let's call it what it is a signal of not of the power of the state, but of the state's understanding and arrangements. I'll use the word alliance with the cartels.
Yeah, and it just, I was reminded when I saw that of AMLO's statements a couple of months ago where he was bragging and boasting about how he gets allowed or his teams get allowed through cartel checkpoints. Do you remember that?
That's right. The I've forgotten the word in Spanish. I'm sorry, but it's the social welfare teams. Bienestar.
Yeah. So again, acknowledging that his government doesn't have full control of Mexican territory, but then when asked, denying it. So.
Or maybe they have full control, but in two different
branches. Working together.
The legal branch and the not legal branch.
Yeah.
And we've had conversations, I mean, we'll respect the privacy of those with whom we spoke, but we've had conversations with individuals who have implied that very heavily, that the sovereignty of the state extends throughout Mexico. Well, if you understand it in an alternative way, which is that sovereignty, to your point, is expressed both through legal and illegal organizations, maybe that's technically true.
Maybe. Maybe the thing here is that they have the sovereignty of the state, but they are controlling the state in all the ways they can. They are using the normal and the legal ways that we know, but they are also using, and that's why they call the president anarco presidente.
Yeah.
He have that nexus, he have that alliance.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we actually will talk about that, and we actually will talk about Claudia again. So we have a lot to cover today, but before we jump off of the topic of the border, I wanted to talk a little bit about SB4. The new law, which I think we've actually, you and I have talked about this before on
we
the
have.
Show.
Yeah, the litigation around it.
Yeah, so it's just basically a law that creates a new state offense for crossing illegally from a foreign country into Texas or entering or reentering, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is the one that I had talked about that I testified in favor of, and there was like 20 people testifying against of. So this is not new on the show, but it's interesting because this is a bill to deter illegal entries, right? Like we've talked about. But this is a bill that's gotten a lot of bad rap. We were just talking about this earlier with Humberto, and I've gotten a lot of people asking me, a lot of, frankly, terrified people asking me if this is going to mean mass deportations or racial profiling or separating families. And so I think that there is a lot of misconceptions related to this bill. And so I wanted to unpack that a little bit. And then I wanted to unpack the reactions that we've been getting on this for a while now. To no surprise, it's created a legal battle. I think everybody expected that. So let me unpack that a little bit. So last month, the law was temporarily blocked after David Ezra, an Austin-based judge, said that it would open the door to each state passing its own version of immigration laws.
Right.
And then on March 5th, the Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito also put the law on hold. Now we've had a lot of recent developments. So this Tuesday, in a 6-3 vote, the Supreme Court allowed it to go immediately into effect. But now an appeals court has stopped the law from being enforced.
Fifth Circuit, yeah, it was allowed for like, what, like 4 or 5 hours, and then Fifth Circuit reimposed.
So it's like a total roller coaster.
Yeah.
Do you want to add anything to that, or do you want to talk about reactions?
We should talk about reactions. I think it's worth clarifying for the viewers, for the listeners, that Senate Bill 4 passed in the special session of the 88th Texas Legislature last year. We should clarify what it does and doesn't do. What it does is it empowers Texas law enforcement officers. If they see somebody violating the international border, you know, entering illegally, then they're allowed to apprehend them. And then upon apprehension, essentially they get two choices. They can either be transported to a legal port of entry and cross of their own volition back into Mexico, or they can choose to, you know, avail themselves of their rights under the 14th Amendment, because the 14th Amendment applies to persons, not to citizens, and essentially be apprehended, jailed, and receive adjudication, whether it's trial or anything else, from the judiciary of the state of Texas. So it's state offense, state enforcement. It's not mass deportations. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be hunts for Hispanics, Latin Americans, Mexican Americans, anything else. It's if there's a crime witnessed, law enforcement has the power to stop it, which is a completely ordinary exercise of state plenary power in every sense, except in the fantasy world of too much of the judiciary and modern progressivism. So thank you for coming to my rant on that.
Yeah.
But we had reactions to it, right? I mean, it's been over
so
the top. Yeah.
Real quick, I want to ask you, Humberto, What do the Mexican people think about this? Like, what is perceived down there about this new law?
I think, and first, before I respond to the question, I would like to say that I think that there's a big problem on the narrative control. And why I'm saying this? The reaction in Mexico is, and you can check almost all the media, the public media, the private media, the TV, radio, whatever media you want. And the general reaction is racist profiles, massive deportations. They even talk about the racism that exists in Texas and the governor, and they attack publicly to all this. But they never find what is happening, what the law is really about. They said that the law is only to guarantee the police the faculty to apprehend all the people they like, only on suspicion, and deported it into Mexico.
Yeah.
Without any other proof, without any suspicion, without anything. And the truth is not that.
Yeah.
But the narrative has taken all this so they can put it into something that unites Mexico against one enemy. And this is something that happened before in AMLO's election.
Texas.
No, against Donald Trump.
Oh, pardon me. But the one enemy now is Texas.
The enemy now is Texas.
Yeah.
Before it happened when AMLO take Donald Trump as the public enemy. And I understand that what happened in Mexico, sometimes it stays in Mexico, but it affects all of us. So having a little bit of idea of what the narrative is in Mexico and to go out and say the truth, and that's why I think this is really valuable that you told us what is about the law. I think that is need to be out a little bit more, to explain that a little bit more. So that's the problem in Mexico.
Can I, if I could, I mean, there were two things that I saw that really I thought were very striking about this. One was merely the fact that Mexican officialdom, whether it was, who's the lady at SRE now, Becerra, is that right?
Yeah,
Alicia Barcena.
Barcena, so sorry. My apologies, Madame Barcena. But the foreign minister, Madame Barcena, was commenting at length on U.S. judicial process.
Yeah.
You know, as if it, you know, and that was something obviously in which they're very well informed, and to a much greater degree than the United States. I'll put it this way: if an American office holder had ever commented on the Mexican judiciary or Mexican politics at that mm-hmm. granular level, you can imagine the freakout in Mexico. Like, they would lose their minds over it. But they feel perfectly free to pronounce upon that. So that's one thing. The other thing that struck me is that there is this with the regime, the 4T and the Morenistas and everything like that. They're totally fine with human trafficking going north. They have no problem with that. And so they don't lift a finger to stop it. In fact, as we've discussed, they're complicit with the cartels to do it. But as soon as somebody comes back south, whoa, hang on, you know, that's completely unacceptable. And you have to guess. I mean, this is just me. I want to impute views to either of you. But I think there's got to be a profit motive somewhere down the line attached to that. Like, you can't make money off people returning south, but you can make money off people flowing north. I'll give you a bonus third item, too. The bonus third item is this, that when you look at the rhetoric, both from Claudia Sheinbaum and from Barcena and from Roberta Velasco, best friend, in Mexico, the thing that struck me as incredibly dangerous, and I'll be, you know, candid with you, I mean, you're a Mexican national, I'm a Texan, but as a Texan, I'm very offended by this. And actually, as a Mexican-American Texan, I'm very offended by this. Their belief that they speak for Mexican-Americans in Texas. And this constant invocation of, well, the state is 40%, it's 40% Latino, you know, they'll rise up and we're going to protect them and things like that. And it's insulting in full candor. I mean, what are your thoughts?
I think at the end, even though they say that they are speaking to the Mexican-American here,
mm-hmm.
they are not really speaking to them. They actually don't care about that. They're speaking only to the Mexicans. And what's the message that the Mexicans receive when they say that kind of things? Oh, we have a government that protects us. We have a government that will raise their hand against the bigger enemy.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they have no trouble on saying that. Because they are not speaking to the people here.
The audience.
They're only speaking to Mexicans.
The audience is not here.
Yeah.
Okay.
They are using the narrative and they are using all this to manipulate Mexicans in Mexico. Because those are the voters.
They do think, though. I don't disagree with that, and you would know better than I would anyway. But tell me what you think of this. I mean, it does seem to me that they believe that the Mexican state, the Morenistas, believe that they really are an interest group, a lobbying group within the United States, that they're participants in U.S. process. And again, they would never allow. I mean, if the Americans tried that, they would never allow it in Mexico.
They think so. Yeah, okay. I also believe that. I think that they believe they have the power to convince all the Mexican Americans to vote one way or the other.
Yeah.
That's completely not true. That's something that I think is not true. But they are convinced that they can.
Yeah.
And they are using it so they can be in the spotlight. They are using in a way of election manipulation.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah.
Well, I think you covered the reactions pretty well. They were predictable. There was also some quotes of, you know, them calling Governor Abbott racist, saying that they won't accept the repatriations, all of these things. But I want to move on to a different topic. Josh, in our last two episodes, we actually discussed different U.S. investigations into AMLO's different campaigns and these, you know, accusations that his allies had worked with different drug cartels and taken money from different drug cartels. I think the one that we talked about was referring to the 2006 campaign. But since then, there has been new foreign press reporting on allegations that allies from Andrés Manuel López Obrador had accepted money from drug cartels as after his election in 2018.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
So I know that's something that we wanted to talk about, but for some reason, U.S. law enforcement agencies refused to open up an investigation into this and actually concluded that there was little appetite to pursue allegations against the leader of one of America's top allies.
Well, we should be clear that we know the reason that they didn't do it, and it was because the Obama administration, which is the same people as the Biden administration, really wanted to let AMLO and the Mexican left off the hook for political reasons. So they weren't looking out for the interests of the United States, and they weren't looking out for the interests of Mexico either. They were looking out for their own political advantage in that particular case, and that's why a man who is, again, this is just my opinion, but I think it's demonstrably true, an ally of the Sinaloa cartel in particular is currently president of Mexico. Oh. Sorry. Go ahead, please.
Well, another thing that I wanted to talk about is, obviously, to nobody's surprise, López Obrador denied it. Like, he completely denied it. But something else, he criticized the Times, obviously, but something else that he did is he actually came out in a mañanera, and on a very big screen, he displayed the New York Times' reporter's name and out loud read her phone number in front of everybody. And in a country where you know that members of the press are in danger, they're killed at insane rates in Mexico, and
it's the most dangerous country to be a journalist in the world.
Believe it or not, right here next door. That was insane to me when I found that out. But he later defended that. I think he was under investigation from the Mexico's Freedom of Information body, and he's defended it and said that he did not regret it. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on all of this and why it seems to be such a sensitive topic for this administration.
I think you should go first.
Perfect. Well, AMLO's administration since 2018, that when he get into the administration, he had been controlling the narrative almost all day by these mañaneras. He wake up really early, he start talking about the topic of the day, and everybody falls on that, except for two main topics, the narco presidente and the gray house of his son here in Houston. There are the only two topics that has taken the narrative of him. I think that's the first thing that he hates. He wants to be the one that imposes what are we talking and why are we talking about. And the second part that he scares is that, okay, now I lose the narrative. But I lose the narrative in something that may take me accountable, not only in Mexico, but in the US. and in the US they are not going to be playing with me. And I am ending my administrations in a few months. And in Mexico, we don't have a re-election.
Right.
So I'm thinking that he's really scared of what could happen to him in the next years, in the next months. That's why he react like that. That's why he start threatening people. That's why he released the phone number. And when someone say, hey, this was bad, he was like, okay, and I will do it again. I don't care.
So you think he's trying to bully the Americans? Is that really it? It's less a domestic play and more a signal to the Americans to back off, don't pursue this investigation.
Because he's seeing himself in a corner surrounded by something that really can hurt him and can hurt his image. And the problem with AMLO is, or one of the problems with AMLO, he wants to be remembered as one of the heroes of Mexico.
Yeah.
And he cannot have this image that is a corrupt image or a narco image. He needs to be as clean as possible.
He wants to be like Benito Juarez and be on the money. And
so you think it's more of a personal thing, Humberto? It's not necessarily a concern for his own party?
I don't think he have the concern of his own party. I think he believes that he is like a messias. He's like the hero. He's the savior of Mexico. So if the party receive or not the money, he doesn't really care about it.
Yeah.
He cares about what the history will say about AMLO. That he is not longer this hero, this amazing people that he's trying to sell to the people.
Yeah, and he's the desperation starting to show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been interesting, though, to see the his decision, because there was the original ProPublica reporting about the connections between the Mexican president and the Sinaloa cartel. And then there was a follow-up New York Times report as well. And I mean, look, as much as this reporting can be for certain, it's pretty close. I mean, I think it would be very foolish to assume that he's not connected to the cartels at this point. And, you know, adventures like Claudia's up north in Tamaulipas just sort of illustrate the point. But, you know, when he released Natalie Katrov.
I think it's Katrov.
Katrov? Okay, mm-hmm. Well, we'll assume it's Katrov, but apologies to Natalie, whatever your last name is pronounced as. But she's a very good reporter. New York Times reporter in Mexico City. He reads out her phone number, as you said.
Yeah.
But then that from a comedic element, that spurred, like, this release and counter-release of various phone numbers. And Claudia Sheinbaum, actually went and defended AMLO. And then somebody released her phone number, and then she posts a video saying just how horrible it is that people are calling her on her number now that she's gotten the same thing.
How does it feel?
And the icing on the cake is that she started screenshotting. I mean, this woman's going to be president of Mexico, by the way. She started screenshotting people who sent her WhatsApp messages and sharing their phone numbers, too. And so it's this endless cycle. Go ahead.
And to be true, I will not doubt that the leaking of these other phone numbers of the 4T administration was an internal job. It was a strategy of AMLO, like, okay, I do this, that is bad, leaking the phone number of the journalist. Put some numbers out of the administration so they see that doesn't matter, that it's okay.
That we're victims too.
Yeah. I will not doubt on that.
Really?
I have nothing to make me believe that is completely true, but I will not doubt on that. That's the way he do things.
Well, since we're talking about Claudia, actually, let's keep talking about her. We've known that she's the front runner for a very long time. Yeah. She's had a very good lead in the polls for a while. As we know, she's the protege of the current president. But we were just talking about this recently, and she seems to be getting a little bit weaker in the polls. And I'm curious why you guys think that is.
In 2018, AMLO wins with a 30-point the advantage over the
30 point? 30 point? He won with 30 points?
Yeah, well, okay. 30 point of advantage.
Okay.
30 points more than the second place.
Sure.
And everybody thought last year and the year before, that the one that follows AMLO was going to be winning by something like that.
Mm-hmm.
As today, the opposition said that Xochitl is almost in a tie with Claudia. I think that's not the truth. That's not going to happen, in my personal opinion. But what is real is that the gap is not as big as the gap that AMLO have. because Claudia is not this charismatic leader that AMLO was in 2018.
No.
Claudia has not this almost 12 years of being around Mexico, visiting all the towns in Mexico. And there is 6 years of losing popularity of the administration. I think the real numbers are something between 15 to 22%,
okay,
more than the second than Xochitl. Then that will be the real gap, in my opinion. I think they are going to win, even though I don't want them to win.
Right.
But I think that's the truth.
So if she wins, I mean, we've talked about this in private, but I'll share with the audience. What do you predict the margin is going to be when Claudia wins?
Something between 15 to 22%.
15 to 22, and so I mean, obviously, in an American election, that would be considered an absolutely crushing margin.
That's huge.
It's huge. I mean, it's unheard of at this point. But for Mexico, that's going to be regarded as a failure. Is that right?
Not a failure. It will be also a huge win. But we need to take into account that the last win, the AMLO win,
30%.
Was 30 points.
So she's going to walk in weaker than her predecessors.
Yeah.
But there were times where we thought that the gap would be even bigger.
Yeah. So she's losing that. But I don't think the opposition has the strength to really win it, even though they are saying that they can.
Right. Xochitl Galvez is not going to.
In my opinion, she's not going to.
You don't see her getting stronger in the last couple of months?
There's a big problem, in my opinion, with the opposition. For a long time in Mexico, we only have three parties.
Right.
The party that governed Mexico, that was a PRI, that it was in a center idea. The right-handed, that was a PAN. And the left-handed, that was a PRD.
PRD. Mm-hmm.
And for 60 years, they fight one to the other, saying that one is the worst and the other is the worst and all that. And suddenly, these three parties that for more than 60 years has been saying that the other is the worst, they reunite and say, no, we are the best. We are the... They have no identity. They have no idea what they are representing. The only real proposal that they are giving is, we are not AMLO. We are not Morena. Okay, but what are you defending? What are your principles? What
right.
are your values?
Right.
So, in my opinion, they don't have the strength to really convince people. Because there are a lot of people that said, I will never vote again for PRI, because PRI was 70 years in power and they do nothing. And I will never vote for PAN, because PAN was 12 years in power and they do nothing. So they don't have that coalition to make a strong team that can defeat Morena. That's my view of things.
I almost feel sorry for PRD. I mean, they never got... Well, they won elections, they just weren't allowed to take power. So,
yeah, but I think that's the only party that they have never lost an election.
Yeah, well, fair. Fair. Yeah.
Can I ask you one more thing that we've been hearing some rumors about? There's these rumors about a potential autogolpe that we're hearing about. What are you hearing?
I think that's a strategy of the opposition to continue saying that AMLO is the worst thing, and it is the worst thing.
We should define, sorry to interrupt, we should define what an autogolpe is for the audience, because I don't think everyone will know.
An autogolpe is a coup that AMLO is going to give to his own administration so he can remain in power.
It's a self-coup.
So like proclaiming like a state of emergency,
exactly.
Basically, so that he can stay.
I think this is more an idea of the opposition, that they are putting out the idea. I don't think this is going really to be happening because the gap that they have. If we were talking about 2%, 3% or something like that, okay, we are in a probability scenario where this could happen. But with 15, 20 points, the truth is he doesn't need it.
Yeah.
And that will be against his image.
It would be detrimental.
So...
Yeah.
I don't see it. I think it's more the strategy of the opposition saying that he wants to continue in power. I hope that is not true, but I also don't see it.
Josh, do you think that could ever happen?
An autogolpe? I mean, in Mexican history, it has happened. So it's not unprecedented, but you have to go back almost a century to see. Who would the last guy be? Obregón, maybe? Caius?
Yeah.
Caius. It's back as Caius, mm-hmm. I guess. But that's 1920s, right? 1920s, yeah. Early 1930s.
Almost one center.
First of all, I have no evidence that it's in the offing right now. I think it's pretty clear that AMLO is trying the Putin strategy of having, you know, Claudia as the Dmitry Medvedev of Mexico, and she's going to be the puppet that he controls. What is it? Titere. Thank you. Who knows? Anything's possible. Especially if I think to your point, Umberto, if he feels cornered enough by the Americans, by domestic pressure. I don't think anything's off the table, do you?
Exactly.
Yeah, nothing's off the table, especially if the army feels threatened.
Yeah, but as today, with today's scenario, I think we're not there.
Agreed.
If the U.S. government start looking further into the narco presidente, and if the gap gets shorter,
right,
and maybe we'll be in the scenario.
And if Sedena runs half the country now, and if they feel threatened, then
they will try it.
Of course.
So it's not out of the ideas,
mm-hmm.
but maybe today is not the most probable scenario.
I think that's right.
Thank you. I want to talk about some recent news. This has been going on for years, funny enough, but it's become recent news this week because of some new developments, and it's going to require a little bit of background for our listeners because, to be honest, I was talking about this with Umberto. I had never heard about this before until you brought it up to me. And this is about the news that the Mexican government is preparing to take control of it's like a gravel pit and a port that's owned by a company named Vulcan Materials Company.
Yes.
I think they're from Alabama.
They are.
But they own this huge stretch of property in the Caribbean coast.
In Quintana Roo, I think.
Yeah, it's right by Playa del Carmen,
right,
which is a beautiful area. But they... AMLO has been trying to negotiate with them for years and offering to buy that property for a very long time, but they have failed to produce a deal. And so he's been feuding with them. And recently in 2021, actually a couple of years ago, this is when the whole feud started, Mexico's environmental ministry closed their gravel pit and forbade the company from operating and exporting stone. And so the president since has accused the company of extracting rock without permits. It's been this ongoing fight where they said, well, we have permits, but either way, the police held the port and used it for their own purposes. So for Cemex to bring in cement and other things. But this has been a fight for a very long time. But fast forward to July, this is kind of an important thing in the story, but AMLO offered to buy it for about $380 million. And the company came back and said, well, you know, we have these papers that, like, they had filed these papers saying that it was worth at least $1.9 billion.
Right.
But
right.
AMLO had said that this was a fair offer, that they had done some government assessments. But that kind of gives a little background on this constant fight. And the reason that this is relevant is because AMLO has said before, he's threatened before, that this needs to be resolved by the time that he leaves office in September. And he has threatened that he will seize the property if this is not resolved by then.
I think they're about to seize it.
They are.
They are about
to
seize it, yeah.
Some of the recent developments, do you want to talk about what we've heard this week?
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's been very interesting. So, I mean, as you say, Vulcan Materials is a construction aggregate firm out of Alabama, and it operates in Mexico. You and I have talked a little bit about this. I mean, one of the things that is, just to be blunt, you know, the key to prosperity for Mexico is actually establishing Mexico as a foreign investment destination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ability of foreign firms to come and you know, operate plants and employ people and create jobs and the whole nine yards and generate investment is an absolute necessity for Mexico to get to where, in candor, it ought to be, which, you know, Mexico should be. Do you remember back in 2012, there was all this press about Mexico finally becoming a middle-class nation?
Yeah.
Remember that? And it didn't actually happen. I think it was like technically briefly true, and then it's definitely not true now.
Yeah.
But part of the reason it's not true now is because the business climate, for reasons of security, became very unfriendly. But then, in addition to the security issues, which from a macro perspective were somewhat manageable. I don't want to overstate that. But now that the government has been leftist for 6 years, they've essentially killed any desire to reinvest. I mean, there's a reason that nearshoring in Mexico is mostly taking place in the context of Chinese firms that are moving to Mexico, and that carries with it a whole basket of other costs that come with it. But you know, outfits like Vulcan Materials, who have been bullied by the Mexican president. By the way, I mean, one thing you didn't mention, do you remember why? Do you know why he's targeting Vulcan Materials?
The thing that I know is that when he went to supervise the construction of the Tren Maya, and everybody was saying that he was killing all the peninsula natural resources.
Yeah.
He saw Vulcan and he saw like, okay, I'm going to take out the Vulcan authorization so they don't continue killing the natural resources of the peninsula.
Yeah.
Only I can do it.
It's become, well, that's exactly right, though. It's become wrapped up in his ego with this mega project, which was the Mayan train, the Tren Maya.
Well, and also, side note, like, the things that he's saying that he wants to do with it, like, he said that the best part about this whole property is, like, the freight shipping dock, which he wants to use for cruises, and that there's this big cement pit, which, by the way, is infested with crocodiles. And he was like, we could use that for ecotourism and make them into swimming pools and all of these things, which is very AMLO.
Well, you know, I mean, part of the tactics that got him involved in the past year, of course, is that he had Samar. He had the Navy actually raid the property at one point on a phony pretext. And so, I mean, when you look at it, it seems inevitable to me that Vulcan Materials is going to lose. It's going to lose its investment in Mexico. It's not the first one. There was the Spanish electricity firm. I've forgotten. It's the generation firm. Anyway, we'll take my word for it, since we've both forgotten the name of the firm. But he's targeted Spanish businesses before. Mm-hmm. I think this is the first major American business that's been nationalized. And ideologically, of course, it's very important for Morena because, you know, they celebrate the legacy of like Lázaro Cárdenas and seizing the oil fields and things like that. And so it's a big deal. But once this is done, it's almost impossible to see major U.S. Investment, at least in manufacturing, going back into Mexico. I mean, Tesla just built his factory outside of Monterrey. But you know, I have questions about how that's going to work. Not through any fault of Tesla's, but you know, can they get the goods from Monterrey to across the border to Nuevo Laredo or Brownsville or wherever they're going? It seems very grim. You know, one thing I'm interested in your perception. You and I have talked before, obviously off camera, about how life changed after 1994 in Mexico. A lot more consumer goods, a lot more choice. You know, a higher standard of living becomes available. Same thing happened in South Texas, by the way, with this trade. What happens? Like, why? What is the political benefit in threatening that achievement on the Mexican side?
A little bit of context of
Please.
What we have been
yes.
talking
yes.
Outside cameras. In Mexico, in the 80s, more or less, it was a protectionist economic idea.
Yeah.
In which only Mexicans can produce and we have a few things that came from the US. I'm talking, for example, with my parents, they told you that candies, that the Snickers, Milky Way, the normal candies that in the US you have it, they need to travel to the US and they smuggle candies to Mexico because there were no candies until 1993, 1994, when the treaty of free commerce start.
Yeah.
And Mexico opened the borders, and we were like, okay, let's have all this. One of the ideas of AMLO is not openly said, but to have this protectionist economy in which everything is allowed, but Mexicans have this preference.
Yeah.
Mexicans and his allies.
Ah.
And today the U.S. is not the ally of AMLO's administration. So, for example, there are a lot of Chinese that want to mine different regions of Mexico, and AMLO is not taking out their lands. He's attacking Spain. He's attacking the U.S. He's attacking Canada, but he's not attacking the other countries.
Communist China can take as much lithium as it wants.
As they want. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the difference that we're having. Before it was like, okay, we close borders and we produce everything, and what we cannot produce, we import it from the US. Mm. Now is we don't close borders, but we give preferred treat to some allies. And that allies are not the US now, so. Mm.
Well, we'll have to see what happens, but there's some very reliable reports that are saying that the seizure is imminent, that AMLO will declare that area the natural protected area. So we will update our listeners and we will see what happens. But I wanted to start talking a little bit about our announcement. And Josh, I can hand it off to you, but we have a very special announcement to make.
We do. Umberto is on the show, not just because he's a friend, although he is, and not just because he knows everything about Mexican politics and society, although he does. But because, as you know, The Hard Country is a production of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we've been involved in, just for background, we've been involved in border security work now for 6 years, almost, and almost as long as AMLO's been around, actually. It's almost like he created the need. but, you know, one of the things that we've come to understand as we've engaged in this subject matter is that you can't just solve the problem north of the border. Obviously, there are multiple policies, and we advocate for them, that the United States can and ought to do, and that Texas can and ought to do to secure the border. But the reality is that, you know, the one constant for Texas in particular is that Mexico is always going to be a neighbor, and that as Mexico rises or falls, so too does the security of our borders. So from a standpoint of pure self-interest, we actually have an interest in a strong, stable, and sovereign Mexico, where it is the best place for Mexicans to be. And it doesn't exist right now. So we have been very privileged over the past year, a little bit more than a year now at this point, to work with Fundación Patria Unida, your think tank, you and your wife, Alice Galvan, and understanding Mexico and advancing projects. And we have made the decision, in fact, it was announced today as we record this, that we're launching a initiative called the Double Legal Alliance, Alianza dos Águilas, that's actually going to do several things. But one of the things it's going to do is support your efforts to make Mexico strong, free, and sovereign. And so, you know, those of you listening to The Hard Country, you're not the first to hear it, because people here at the Texas Public Policy Foundation's annual summit have already heard this. But Umberto, do you want to share any thoughts on that?
Well, I think, as I have already shared with you more than the one time, that the things that help Mexico also help the U.S. And the things that help the U.S. also help Mexico. Either, even if we are separated by the border, we have more in common than the things that separate us. And we can work together and we can rise together against all these threats that we have today. And we can be talking about insecurity, about migration, about a lot of things that threaten our society. But we can work together so we can solve it, and we can have a better place to live, and a better Mexico, and a better US, and a better Texas for us and for our kids. So that's the main goal for me and for Patronita.
We're glad to have you on board.
Amazing. Very exciting. And we will continue to update our listeners and anything else we have. But aside from that, is there anything else that you guys want to talk about today?
I'm good, Umberto.
I think we covered a lot of ground.
Thanks for doing it. Melissa, as always, thanks for an expert job moving us along. Yeah.
Thanks, Josh, and thank you, Umberto, for being here with us today. It's a pleasure to have you in Texas, and it won't be the last time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to all of our listeners, and we will see you next time.